This is hashtag history episode 79. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And it's already our last episode of the season before we are joined next week by some super special guests to help us close out our season 8 finale.
Yes, we will be making the big reveal about next week's guest at the end of the episode. So make sure you stick around all the way through the end of the episode so you can hear who it is.
And you'd want to stick around for the whole episode anyway, because this episode we are covering a wildly fascinating topic.
Yeah, it really is.
I'm crazy excited about this week. So this week we are discussing the murder of Gianni Versace, a world-renowned fashion designer that would go on to quite literally revolutionize the fashion industry. He was shot and killed on the steps of his mansion in Miami Beach when he was only 50 years old by what is known as a spree killer, Andrew Cunanan. In the spring and summer of 1997, Cunanan, who had never had a criminal record before, would go on a killing spree, killing 5 people over the course of only 3 months. But why would Versace be one of Cunanan's unfortunate targets, you might ask? Mm-hmm. Well, despite the fact that the Versace family has denied for nearly 25 years that there was any connection between Versace and Cunanan, and that this was just, you know, one of his random murders, there may actually be evidence that shows that the two had met before Versace's tragic death.
Ooh.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, that was good. We will be doing a deep dive into Versace, his overwhelming mark on the fashion world, Cunanan, and, well, I guess his unfortunately overwhelming mark on the world, and the murder of Gianni Versace that would leave an overwhelming mark on the entire world this week on hashtag history. But first, a cocktail.
It's a cocktail time.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Leah.
And this is hashtag history.
The podcast for both history nerds and history haters alike,
where we dive into history's greatest stories of controversy, conspiracy, and corruption.
So, first off, we have to thank this week's cocktail sponsor.
Yes.
You all know her.
You do. You know her.
It's Alicia Gutierrez Romin, who actually has purchased us 3 cocktails because she's
amazing.
Amazing.
She's amazing. Yeah. You all might know her from our episode. It was our last season finale guest, right?
Mm-hmm.
She talked about criminal abortions throughout California history. And we got so much feedback on that episode. People really loved her and all the information that she had to bring. So we know her. We love her. And so do you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thanks, Alicia.
Thank you so much.
Okay. So this is very, just like it always is for me, a very literal cocktail
love,
for
love
us.
That. Mm-hmm.
This one is just the Versace cocktail.
Perfect.
So it contains, I said to Rachel as I was making it, I'm measuring with my heart.
Yeah, and she did. She did.
So I mean, there, I have like serving sizes here, but I think it's for like a pitcher of this stuff. So it says like 0.5 serving orange.
Okay.
Don't know what that is. 8 ounces of vodka.
We have 8 ounces of vodka in this?
No, I just did like a shot. Or I guess 2 ounces in each of ours.
Okay.
And then a can of peach nectar.
Yum. Oh my God.
Yeah. And then you like blend it all together, blend with ice. So it gets kind of like frothy and icy. And and yeah.
It looks incredible. You started off by making us kind of a smaller one and instantly changed your mind that we must have larger glasses.
Yeah, as soon as I poured it, it split it into our 2 glasses. I was like, well, no.
That's certainly not
enough. That's ridiculous.
I'm really, really excited.
All right, well, cheers.
Cheers.
What's not to love?
There's nothing not to love. And you made the point, too, that with it, the liquor in here being vodka, I mean, that makes it taste like there is no liquor in it.
Mm-hmm.
This is so, 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 so good.
Yeah.
I wish you had made a pitcher.
I mean, I still have the peach nectar or whatever it is. Yeah, peach nectar.
Oh, this is amazing.
Mm. Well, sorry, this is a boring cocktail segment, but
is there a trend of the better the cocktail, the more boring the segment? Because
yeah.
We're just like, this is amazing. Don't mind us while we sit here and drink all of it. Right?
Yeah, I also have been finding it harder and harder to get like historic, you know, like things that I can like really connect to the story.
You didn't want to do the history of peaches?
I mean, I guess I could dive into that for you now. Yeah, I could. But instead, I'll just drink more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a 10 out of 10. Mm-hmm.
It's a 10 out of 10.
That's for you, Deanna.
That was easy.
That was easy.
Okay, moving on.
Oh, you drank some.
It's good. It's good.
It's a good one.
Okay, so before we begin this episode, I do need to just quickly address the pronunciation of Versace. Have you heard this before?
No.
Okay, so I wanted our listening audience to know that I am aware that actually the correct pronunciation of Versace is actually Versace.
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 That sounds Italian, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was an interview that Donatella did. So Donatella, for those that don't know, is Gianni Versace's sister. And she said something, you know, it was like, it was one of the first questions that they asked her was, you know, what is something that you wish people knew about you or about the Versace family or whatever? She was like, well, first of all, it's Versace. That's the first thing I'd like you to know. So I was like, oh, okay. So I want to address that I am aware that technically the pronunciation that I'm going to use throughout this entire episode is incorrect. However, because it is the more well-known pronunciation of the name being Versace,
we're just going to disregard that.
We're going to disregard the correct pronunciation and we're going to use the more well-known pronunciation.
Yeah.
So that's all I wanted to say.
Well, that's like how British people, they know it's Nike, but they still say Nike.
Yeah, because that's the way that they choose to do it.
Because that's just how everybody else does it.
Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm following the social norms here, I guess. So Gianni Versace was born on December 2nd, 1946 in Reggio Calabria, Italy. Following the death of an older sister, Versace became the middle child between his older brother, Santo, and his younger sister, Donatella. Versace was interested in fashion and design from a very early age, apprenticing at his mother's dressmaking business when he was only a kid, and officially began working for her after high school. In 1978, he opened his first boutique in Milan and did his first fashion show with his brother serving as CEO and his sister as vice president. He would go on to become one of the most well-known and sought-after designers of the 1980s and 90s. Very much inspired by ancient Greek history and design, Versace was known to produce very flashy, bold, colorful designs. There were many haters that said his designs were too gaudy or even vulgar, but that didn't stop him. And it didn't stop the celebrities that adored him and continued to flock to him for more. In fact, some of his closest celebrity supporters included Madonna, Cindy Crawford, Elton John, Naomi Campbell, and, of course, Princess Diana. Mm. A quote from Versace was, quote, "I think it's the responsibility of a designer to try to break rules and barriers," unquote. And he certainly did that. As he began to become more well-known, he expanded his boutiques throughout the United States and started designing not only clothing, but also publishing books. The brand has now expanded to designing handbags, fragrances, and home decor, including kitchenware, bedding, vases, and more. Mm-hmm. It's certainly a high-end luxury brand because, like, as part of my research, mm-hmm, yeah. I may or may not have done some online window shopping.
Yeah.
And here's just an example of price points here. I looked up how much their socks cost because I thought that would probably be like the least expensive article of clothing.
Yeah.
$50 for a pair of socks. But they're so cute.
But no one's ever going to see them.
I mean, if you had a pair of Versace socks, that's all you wear, correct?
Well, yeah.
You go
Birthday suit with the socks.
Birthday suits and socks.
Okay.
You don't want to draw attention. Well, no, and so you don't want to draw attention away from the socks, but you'd be drawing a lot of attention from the socks.
Yeah.
Anyway, they were like really super cute. They had like the Grecian look. I'm sure that they are the coziest socks one could ever own. So, you know, like sponsor the podcast.
Yeah.
Versace.
Please.
Versace. Please.
Donatella.
Versace was in a relationship with partner Antonio D'Amico that lasted 15 years, only ending because of Versace's death. The two met back in Milan, where they lived together for 6 years before moving together to Miami in 1992. Versace was openly gay and never hid his relationship, but placing this all in the time period of the late 80s, early 90s, the media, by and large, was not comfortable with an openly gay man. So the reason why D'Amico and his relationship with Versace wasn't widely reported on during Versace's life was not because Versace hid this part of his life, but because the media did. Mm. They basically brushed over the fact that he was in this long-term relationship with this guy that was at like nearly every single event with him. Some media outlets even went so far as to airbrush D'Amico out of photographs. That's crazy,
that's
right?
That's crazy.
And something that you and I had talked about just before we started recording was that you and I have both watched the 2018 FX series, Assassination of Gianni Versace, which is so good.
So good.
It's so good. We had touched, you know, on the fact that we both have watched that. And so then, you know, there was like this scene in the show where Versace was doing an interview where he was like coming out in that interview. I don't know if you remember that, but they did like a just like kind of an interview, like, this is my partner.
Yeah.
And it was like a really big
Ricky
deal.
Ricky Martin. Here's my partner.
Here's my partner, Ricky Martin. it was a really big deal in the show.
Yeah.
That was a dramatization. Like, that part was not true. Versace always lived his adult life as like an outwardly gay man with a longtime partner.
Yeah.
So it was the media that actually kind of airbrushed, literally and figuratively, that part of his life out.
Which is just so funny and counter to what I feel like would be happening today. Mm-hmm. Like, if someone was like going, you know, when it going to events with, you know, someone of the same sex, the media would be like, are you gay? And they'd be like, no, this is my cousin, George. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like nowadays the media would like want to just.
Oh, yeah. And latch on to like, who is this person?
Yeah.
And find out everything about them and everything about their relationship. And yeah, I agree.
Interesting.
So speaking of that show that we just talked about, the 2018 FX series, mm-hmm. it's called Assassination of Gianni Versace, An American Crime Story. Again, it's so good. It's so good. In that show, it does allude to Versace and D'Amico having an open relationship. Obviously, always still totally committed to one another, but there are a few scenes in the show where Versace is seen sleeping with other people. I dug and dug and dug in my research to find supporting evidence for that, and I was unable to find anything. If anyone listening to this episode has more information about that outside of the dramatization of that show, please message us, because I would love to learn more. I just couldn't find anything.
Yeah.
Either way, they were in an extremely committed relationship with one another. They were besties, and Versace had written in his will that D'Amico would get a significant portion of his money and properties upon his death. Too bad, Versace's family hated D'Amico and would later reverse that. But we'll get into that later.
Mm.
One final note on the personal side of things for Versace. In 1993, Versace was diagnosed with inner ear cancer. We know that in the years leading up to his murder, he actually shied away from the public and lived more of a recluse life, allowing his family to essentially take over the business. According to his sister Donatella, his withdrawal from the public was due to his cancer. She says his ear had grown noticeably large and was very painful, and that he was embarrassed in public, not only because of the look of it, but because he oftentimes struggled to hear what other people were saying.
Oh my gosh.
I know. That's so miserable.
I cannot imagine, like, I mean, having your ear just feel pain. Like, I mean, when I just have, you know, a plugged ear, I feel like I'm going to die.
I would say, we were just talking about this recently, that one of the worst things about, you know, even when you get like a cold, if your ears kind of plug up, that always to me is like the worst part. I'd rather have the runny nose, the sore throat.
Yeah.
I hate the ear plugging. There has also long been speculation that Versace was HIV positive. The lead investigator on his murder case says that he did test positive in his autopsy, but his family has continued to deny these claims. Hmm. Versace truly did change the fashion industry. It was because of Versace that we now have this mesh or like association of celebrities and fashion now. That wasn't a thing before him. As Anna Wintour once told the New York Times, quote, Versace was the first to realize the value of celebrity in the front row and the value of the supermodel and put fashion on an international media platform, unquote.
It's just like, what is fashion if not like a celebrity thing?
I completely agree with that. That's huge, because prior to Versace, the celebrity world and the fashion world were two very separate entities. And like you just said, I think because we grew up in the 90s and 2000s, we don't know fashion separate from celebrities. We know fashion because of celebrities.
Yes.
And I mean, that's exactly it. If I know a designer brand, it's because Sandra Bullock was on the red carpet saying, oh, I'm wearing the blah, blah, blah gown tonight.
Or sitting in the front row
at
New York Fashion Week and I read about it somewhere. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Like, and that's why we even know, I'm trying to think of some supermodels, but even knowing some supermodels, they're celebrities now.
Yeah.
Because they model clothing, like fashion designs.
Oh, what's her name? Cara Delevingne.
I don't know how to say any other names. I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, now same she's deal. A movie star because mm-hmm. she was a became a mm-hmm. superstar fashion model.
And all of that ties back to Versace.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Isn't that wild?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now that we've discussed Gianni Versace at length, we must now look at his killer, Andrew Cunanan. So first, we'll start with a picture.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, in this picture.
I mean, of course I had to pick that picture. Sorry. I picked a picture. I am not trying to romanticize this guy because he's a psycho.
Yeah.
But I thought that this picture encompassed him very well and like who he was in personality.
Yeah. So he's a good looking guy. Mm-hmm. He has a six pack showing with a nice white shirt unbuttoned, flowing in the wind.
Yeah.
Very, very good looking.
Great smile. Great smile. Hair.
Looks like he's having a good time.
Yeah. Speaking of supermodels.
Yeah. No, truly.
Yeah. And again, You all will see the picture when we post on Instagram. I didn't purposefully choose like his best looking picture because I'm trying to romanticize this serial killer. It's because I think that that encompasses who he was so perfectly.
And who he wanted to be.
And who he wanted to be.
Yeah, which we will get into. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Andrew Philip Cunanan was born on August 31st, 1969 in National City, California, which is on the lower border of California below San Diego. Mm-hmm. He was born the baby of the family with three older siblings. His dad, Modesto, had served in the Navy during the Vietnam War. When he returned from service, he became a stockbroker. That's going to become important later. Cunanan's father enrolled him in the Bishop School, which is a super fancy, super wealthy private school. Cunanan was by far his father's favorite kid. Not only did his parents buy him a super nice car to drive, they also gave him the master bedroom in the home.
Oh my God, he Regina George'd them?
Yeah, I didn't make that connection. Yes, that's so crazy to me.
Yeah.
You have other children and you gave one of your, I mean, even like giving any of your kids the master bedroom.
Yeah, that's insane.
But you gave one kid over others the master bedroom.
Wow.
That is wild.
Wow.
Cunanan was pretty brilliant, though, scoring 147 on an IQ test, which is higher than 99% of the general population. But generally, he didn't really fit in at the school with his fellow classmates that came from much wealthier and more socially established families than his own. To make up for this, Cunanan became a prolific liar, telling wild stories about his family, like the fact that his dad was a millionaire and that he was, you know, technically, actually, royalty. I love it. I just wondered, those types of people, did everyone else at the school like, yeah, sure.
Or were they eating it
enamored?
Up?
Enamored.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would hope I'd be one of those people like, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. No, that's, yeah.
Wow.
That wasn't the impression I got from your third birthday party. Yeah. So this odd personality went beyond just being a prolific liar, though. People noticed many other things about him in that he just overall had a lack of empathy for people, had behaviors and responses that were not quote unquote normal, and was generally just kind of odd socially. He was crazy smart. We've already talked about his IQ score, because as the story goes, by the age of 10, he had already memorized the whole set of encyclopedias and could whip out any fact from any one of them by memory.
We know that obviously something more was happening emotionally and everything, but like that does also sound like a form of autism where like you're socially kind of uncomfortable or, you know, distant, but then like just able
academically
or like in other ways, you're like so crazy talented
focused.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I agree.
Interesting.
Despite the majority of his family intentionally casting a blind eye to it, Cunanan was outwardly gay throughout high school and was actually known around the school for having relations with older men while he was in high school.
Yeah.
Despite all of this, he was voted most likely to be forgotten, which... like, can we not?
The 80s were so not nice.
This was a question I was going to have for you. I didn't go to normal school growing up. So do schools do this? Do we still do this?
They do. My school did like best smile, most likely to achieve.
Okay, but not like, but nothing most likely mean. To be a loser.
No, like never.
Okay.
It was all like nice stuff.
So that's what I was like, is this just the 80s? Is this like, you know, just different regions that do this kind of thing? Like, can we stop doing that if that's still a thing?
I really don't think that. I hope schools could allow that anymore.
I really hope not.
Bullying.
Most likely to be printed forgotten.
In your yearbook.
Yes.
That's horrible.
Ugh. I hate that.
Yeah.
Following high school, Cunanan began studying at the University of California, San Diego in 1987, where he majored in American history. So, you know, I feel a little weird now. It's also around this time when Cunanan was 19 years old that his dad up and left the family, fleeing to the Philippines and selling the family home out from underneath them in order to evade arrest for an embezzlement charge he had received while working as a stockbroker. It's also around this time that Cunanan began going to local gay bars more frequently, and his really religious mother came to terms with the fact that her son was gay. Things in the household were really tense between, you know, his father having just left and the family essentially being forced to financially fend for themselves, and between Cunanan's mother disapproving of his sexual orientation. In fact, things were so tense that apparently one time during an argument, Cunanan actually threw his mom up against a wall, causing her shoulder to dislocate.
Ugh.
It wasn't long after this that he officially moved out of the family home and into the home of a female friend of his and her boyfriend in San Francisco. And something to mention here, and I have to make the very public disclaimer that I'm not a psychologist and do not in any way pretend to be or pretend to know really much of anything about psychology.
Yeah.
So what I'm about to share here is not just my personal opinion, but the professional opinion of psychologists that have studied this case.
Mm-hmm.
Many believe in looking at Cunanan's behavior as a young adult that he was like either a psychopath or a sociopath.
Yeah.
And I know these are two different disorders, but what they do have in common is their shared diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder. You kind of already touched on that.
Yeah.
When we were talking about just how smart he was academically, but also socially awkward.
Yeah.
Common things that you'll see in a psychopath or a sociopath include lying consistently and constantly, impulsiveness, aggression, and again, just an overall disregard and lack of empathy for other people. And I think we can agree that up to this point, and certainly further into this episode as we will learn more, we can see these traits in Cunanan.
Mm-hmm.
While living in the San Francisco area, it is believed that Cunanan took up a number of odd jobs, which included things like selling drugs, creating really violent pornography, and perhaps even doing some sex work. The primary way that he funded his lavish lifestyle, however, was by becoming super chummy with rich older men in the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
One such person was a successful businessman named Norman Blatchford. When he and Cunanan first met, Blatchford was living in Phoenix, Arizona. But Cunanan eventually convinced him to move to San Diego and convinced him to purchase a mansion that Cunanan had specifically picked out himself. Isn't that wild? He's so young. He's like early 20s and he's able to swindle these like much older men into literally, I picked out this mansion. You should buy it.
Yeah.
And we should live here together. And I will furnish the whole thing and throw all my lavish parties here on your tab.
The reason why and granted, like you said, I'm not a psychologist. I don't actually know all the differences and stuff, mm-hmm. but I feel like my personal thing is that I think he's a sociopath is because, yeah, we talked about, he was like socially awkward, but mm-hmm. then he's also able to like manipulate people and understand their motives mm-hmm. or like get mm-hmm. into their heads.
That's what I was going to say is like able to absorb specific information about specific people so that he can become the person they want from him. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Totally.
That he can change his personality and his look and his interest and all that based on what he wants from someone.
Yeah.
It's creepy. It's creepy. I'm nothing like that.
No, I am the exact opposite of that.
I am 100% myself, but I'm like, I'm only one person ever.
Yes.
My personality, unfortunately, doesn't change.
Yeah, dependent on who I'm around, not at all.
Unfortunately, I am always me.
Yes.
So this is my own personal opinion, but I think Blatchford, whose partner of 26 years, who had recently passed from AIDS, was in a particularly vulnerable and maybe lonely state at the time. Stories go back and forth about whether or not Blatchford and Cunanan actually had a sexual relationship. But whether they had a sexual relationship or not, they certainly had a financial one. Blatchford gave Cunanan a monthly allowance of over $2,000, bought him a fancy car, and took him on expensive vacations.
You can't convince me they didn't have a sexual relationship.
Oh, I think they absolutely did.
Like, what else would motivate a guy to give a random dude mm-hmm. that like that type of...
Yeah, and you watched the show, and I think, so the series obviously...
It, like, starts with this, I feel
it
like.
It does. Yeah. And the series, obviously, it's not 100% correct, but I think they did a pretty good job. And even in that show, it's, like, kind of vague about whether they did or didn't. Like, you assume, it's implied.
Yeah.
But Cunanan always said, like, oh, no, we didn't. And then even still, like, Blatchford... was in that show, was very invested in Cunanan's education. Like, if I'm going to fund your lifestyle, I'd like some of that money to be going towards you going to school. And so even the show makes it seem implied that there was a sexual relationship, but it was never explicit.
Yeah.
And almost more of this really creepy father-son, like, I care about you.
Sorry, if you could see our faces right now, we're just looking at each other with, like
bewilderment.
Like, bewilderment.
I know. And so, I mean, that's kind of how they displayed it in the show. And that was what I found in my research, too. It's implied. Like you said, it's the assumption, of course.
Yeah.
But Cunanan denied it. Blatchford never explicitly confirmed.
Yeah.
So that's where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
Like I mentioned earlier in the episode, Cunanan was super intelligent, not just clever. And so, I mean, we just talked about this, too. He was able to maintain these relationships with more mature men because he really was in the know on music and art and theology and history and whatnot. There's this story that he knew so much about art that he could speak about any particular art piece, who had created it, what materials were used to create it, and all the places in the world that piece had been displayed. That's wild.
That's wild. Because
he's super smart. So then, you know, when you look at these relationships, I say this all the time, age gap relationships, mm-hmm. when someone is like there's a significant age gap, like 30, 40 years or something like that. I just always wonder, what is there to talk about?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And yeah.
He
was 100% able to.
Yeah.
He was into the same sorts of things that these older men were.
Yeah.
He was super intelligent.
Yeah.
Eventually, Blatchford and Cunanan would break up in 1996. Besides the financial strains in the relationship, there may have also been some jealousy and distrust. Just a year prior, Cunanan had met an architect in a San Francisco bar named David Madsen. Madsen, who was about 6 years older than Cunanan, lived in Minneapolis, but continued a long-distance relationship with him for a handful of months before breaking it off because, as Madsen told his friends, he thought Cunanan was, quote, shady. This was exceptionally heartbreaking for Cunanan, who referred to Madsen as the, quote, love of my life, unquote, and continued to hang Madsen's pictures on his fridge even after the breakup. For Blatchford, he was under the impression that all these solo trips that Cunanan was taking while the two of them were together was to visit an ex-wife and a kid that Cunanan had fabricated.
Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm.
But Blatchford would later find out, of course, that Cunanan was actually visiting Madsen all those times.
Oh my gosh.
That's a wild story to tell, right? Like, my ex-wife and my kid.
Yeah.
Gotta take another trip.
Yeah, sorry.
But no, you're just heading to see your other boyfriend.
Oh my gosh.
And thus, this breakup occurred between the two of them. Who exactly did the breaking up is not known for certain, but we do know that this breakup would change everything for Cunanan. By the following year, he was drinking and using drugs excessively. He had just lost his primary source of income. The love of his life wanted nothing to do with him. And he was also in the midst of losing a close friendship with a friend of his named Jeffrey Trail. Cunanan and Trail had met years before and were close enough that Cunanan considered Trail a, quote, brother. But they had their own recent falling out when Trail became sick of all of Cunanan's lies and antics. Trail ended up moving to Minneapolis for a job, which was also where, if you'll recall, Madsen resided. Mm-hmm. In April of 1997, Cunanan decided to take a trip to Minneapolis to visit Trail and Madsen. Before leaving, he told friends in San Diego that he needed to, quote, settle some business, unquote, with Trail. Mm. Which sounds creepy. I think it could have meant as simply as, like, we're on the rocks,
yeah.
Things aren't great.
Or it could mean I'm going to go murder him.
Spoiler. Spoiler alert. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, now in hindsight, we know it meant I'm going to go kill this guy.
Like, if I said to you, I have to go take care of some business with this person.
I wouldn't want to be the person. Yeah. I mean, that was kind of scary how you said it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I wouldn't think you were going to kill them. What I mean is, like, you were going to verbally
assault them.
Yeah. Like, verbally. Yeah. I mean, just like, yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't think you're killing anyone. I just, like, oh, God, I wouldn't want to be on that side of things.
Yeah.
But not because I think you're about to kill someone.
Got it.
Okay. I would never think that.
But you would think something bad is about to happen.
Yeah. I would think you need to settle some business for someone else. Yes. If you need to settle some business with someone, like, wouldn't want to be that guy. You know? Trail, on the other hand, was quoted as telling his sister that he was not looking forward at all to Cunanan coming to visit and that he never wanted to see him again. It kind of sounds like both of these friends, Madsen and Trail, were just placating Cunanan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were just being nice, but totally wanted to get rid of the guy. When he made it to Minneapolis, Madsen picked him up from the airport and they went to dinner with some of Madsen's friends. The friends say that it was obvious during that dinner that Madsen was uncomfortable the whole evening. Mm. And this is my speculation. Again, it's not something I read. It's just something I'm thinking. But if you actually want to spend time with a friend that flew out to visit you, you don't normally take them out to dinner with a bunch of your friends, right? Like, yeah. If you and I didn't live close to each other, you're coming to visit. And I'm like, cool, let's go hang out with, I don't know how many friends they hung out with. But even if it's like more than 2 to 3 friends that you don't know.
Yeah.
Let's go to dinner with 2 or 3 of my friends that you don't know on your first night here.
Yeah.
Like, I would feel kind of like,
oh, so you really don't want to spend.
So you don't want to be with me. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how I would feel. So again, I just think they were placating. To further placate, Madsen didn't even have Cunanan staying with him for the duration of that trip. In fact, Trail had offered his place to Cunanan, but only while Trail wasn't there. Trail was like, when Cunanan came out to make this trip, Trail was like, bye. He wasn't even in the area.
Yeah.
He was on like a weekend trip with his boyfriend.
Yeah.
He left a key to his apartment under his rug for Cunanan. So that's cool. You can stay at my place. Not going to be there though. So again, talk about not wanting to hang out with this guy, right?
Yeah.
When Trail did return, he and Cunanan got in an argument in Trail's apartment in which Cunanan stole Trail's .40 caliber semi-automatic pistol and left. Mm. Here we go.
Here we go. Ugh.
Hey everyone, I'm Kelly.
And I'm Emily, and we're from Whining About Herstory.
Ever notice how women seem to be missed, forgotten, or maybe even purposely left out of history books?
We did, so we decided to take the his out of history and make it Herstory.
Each episode, we discuss the lives and general awesomeness of these historical Wonder Women, all while having a glass of wine.
Or maybe a bottle. Come join us on all of your favorite podcast platforms at WAH Pod on Instagram, WAH underscore pod on Twitter, and at Whining About Herstory. Remember, that's no H or E in whining.
See you soon. Cheers!
On April 27th, 1997, Trail went to Madsen's apartment to see Cunanan. We don't know for sure why he went over. He may have been coming over because it appears as though Cunanan gave him a call and said, hey, come on by David's place. But perhaps also it was that, you know, he had discovered that Cunanan had stolen his gun and he's going to go retrieve it.
Yeah.
Either way, when he got to Madsen's apartment, Cunanan beat Trail to death with a hammer and then rolled him up in a carpet. Trail's watch stopped at 9:55 p.m., which authorities believe marked his time of death. The following week,
why would your watch stop?
I don't
right
know.
When you die?
I don't know. Like, did it get? I'm assuming it got like hit with the hammer or something.
Okay. Yeah.
You
okay.
Don't know that your Fitbit stops when you die.
Well,
it's we do not detect a heartbeat. Let's shut off.
Like, yeah, that makes sense because it's a Fitbit.
I was even being sarcastic because like mine, I allow mine to die so often, my Fitbit, or like I'm not wearing it or something. If every time I took it off to take a shower, it was like Rachel has died because I don't sense her heartbeat.
Yeah.
I'm assuming
it got
the
hit
hammer
or something.
Hit. Yeah, it was damaged in one way or another.
Okay.
The following week, when Madsen failed to show up to work for 2 days in a row, his coworkers went to his apartment and had the superintendent open the door so that they could search for him. Madsen wasn't there. But we, of course, already know what they did find there was Trail's bloodied and lifeless body rolled up in a rug. Madsen actually became suspect number one for Trail's murder. The body was found in his apartment and he had, like, gone missing, right?
Yeah.
Additionally, there were eyewitnesses that had actually seen Madsen and Cunanan both in the elevator of the apartment complex and walking Madsen's dog outside in the days following the murder. Obviously, this looks super sus, but knowing what we know now, the primary theory is that Madsen likely, you know, was there or walked in on Cunanan killing Trail and that Cunanan then in turn held Madsen hostage.
Yeah, and that's how the show paints it. Mm-hmm. Is like, yeah, people saw them in an elevator, but like he was under direct, like he was there,
gun to his back.
Yeah, gun to his back, fear of his life. Like, yeah, they went out and walked the dog, but he didn't feel safe just running away or telling somebody. Mm-hmm.
I feel like as the general public though, if you were following this as it was happening, it would be, you know, just one of these things where the public's trying to figure it out, like, oh, this sounds super suspicious and stuff, because it almost kind of sounds like the two of them, Madsen and Cunanan,
did it together.
Yeah,
it seems like. That's what it publicly at the time probably seems like.
He goes missing. He was seen walking around with Cunanan casually.
Yep.
In the days following.
Yep.
But here's the next part. Why we can assume that was not the case is because just a few days later, on May 2nd, Madsen's body was then found along the shore of Rush Lake in Minnesota with gunshot wounds to his head and back from the same .40 caliber Cunanan had stolen from Trail. Cunanan then took off towards Chicago. And his next murder is one of real mystery. On May 4th, 1997, a 72-year-old real estate tycoon named Lee Miglin was found dead in his garage. And his murder had been absolutely brutal. He'd been stabbed nearly 24 times with a screwdriver, was bound with duct tape, even like all over his face, and his throat had been slit.
Yeah.
It was also discovered that Miglin's green Lexus was missing. Now, here's why the murder is so mysterious. It is entirely possible that it was an impulse murder, mm-hmm. that Cunanan was driving by, he saw Miglin in his garage with his car, and he decided to kill him on a whim and steal the car. Totally possible. We do know that he left Madsen's red Jeep that he'd been driving, he left it on Miglin Street, and that he did, in fact, take the stolen green Lexus, right? Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that there were no signs of forced entry. In fact, we know that Cunanan spent a significant amount of time inside the Miglin house, whether it be before or after the murder, because it was discovered that he had been in Miglin's bed, that he had left a half-eaten ham sandwich in the kitchen, and that he had shaven and left stubble from his facial hair in the bathroom sink. Like, who does that unless you know you're not going to get caught?
Yeah.
So in the 2018 assassination of Gianni Versace TV series that we keep talking about, they heavily implied that Miglin was privately gay and that he engaged in a romantic relationship with Cunanan in the past, that Cunanan knew that Miglin was going to be alone that weekend as his wife was out of town, and that they were going to have a sexual encounter before Cunanan killed him and took off with his car.
Yeah.
It isn't far-fetched to think that Cunanan would target Miglin. That had been his MO for a long time, you know, was to engage in fiscally beneficial relationships with older, wealthy men. But the Miglin family has repeatedly denied these connections, and I, likewise, was unable to find any evidence to prove as such in all of my research. Even less is known about Cunanan's fourth murder. Miglin's Lexus was soups fancy and actually had a phone in it that authorities were able to track.
Oh.
Super cool.
So cool.
Late 90s technology.
Oh my gosh.
Cunanan was smart, though. He knew this, and he therefore knew he had to ditch this vehicle ASAP. On May 9th, Cunanan shot and killed a cemetery care worker named William Reese and stole his red Chevrolet pickup truck. Little more is known about this murder because it appears to be Cunanan's only murder that did not have ulterior motives outside of simply stealing the truck. Cunanan took this truck and drove to Miami Beach, Florida, where he began staying at the Normandy Plaza Hotel, always paying each night's stay in cash. He would stay at this hotel for some 2 months and would become involved in the Miami gay scene, frequently visiting gay bars and clubs there. And it was while Cunanan was here that he was officially placed on the FBI's most wanted list. Despite how smart and clever this guy is, Cunanan made a really dumb move when, on July 7th, he went into a pawn shop to sell something he had stolen, and he gave them his real name.
Why?
I don't know, for someone that's that smart.
Yeah.
But obviously, I mean, they do background checks on people that when you pawn stuff, they provide that information to authorities.
Yeah. Maybe it just slipped, you know?
Yeah, I think it probably slipped. I also think he maybe was comfortable. He'd been like living in this area undetected for two-ish months at this point. Right. Mm-hmm. So now authorities, you know, they officially knew where he was. And I think that he caught on to this because the following week he checked out of that hotel for the last time. Mm-hmm. And now, 40-something minutes into this episode, we have finally reached the topic for which this episode is titled.
Yeah.
It was July 15th, 1997. Gianni Versace was staying at his 10-room, three-story mansion in Miami Beach. Have you ever seen pictures of it?
No, I don't think I have.
Okay, so we're going to look at some pictures. There's a million. You don't have to do in-depth description. But I just think it's so, this mansion is so amazing.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty. It's, what kind of style does it remind me of?
Like Grecian.
Well,
yeah. This one, not so much. This, like New Orleans almost,
yeah,
right?
New Orleans. Yeah, mm-hmm. Very much the facade of it. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a Grecian looking pool with like, mm-hmm. Really.
I mean, that is just stunning.
Tropical looking. A ginormous bed. That has to be more than like a California King. That's like an extra huge size bed with like a mural on the ceiling.
I feel like five people could sleep in that comfortably.
Oh,
four comfortably if you're like a starfish sleeper.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which I am. There's another one of the pool. It's just beautiful. Oh my gosh. Lush, tropical. It looks like this is the roof of it. Mm-hmm. There's like a catwalk around the roof and you can like see the ocean over all the palm trees. It just looks gorgeous.
It's stunning. That's what I was telling my husband that, not that we intend to go to Florida anytime soon.
Or ever.
Or ever, really. But in an alternate universe, if we were to visit Florida, I was like, we have to see this mansion.
Is it like, can you go and see it?
Yes.
Okay.
Because it's actually now since been converted into a luxury hotel where you can stay for, you know, a starting rate of $750 a night. So,
yeah,
you know, that's on my list, of course. on my dream will never happen list.
Yeah.
Anyway, July 15th, 1997. It was a fairly typical morning routine for Versace to walk the less than half a mile to the news cafe to pick up his daily magazines. At about 8:30 a.m. that morning, he made his usual stroll, picking up 5 magazines at the cafe, and he turned back around to head home. He reached the gates of his home just before 9 a.m., and suddenly, out of nowhere, on the steps to his mansion, Andrew Cronanan came up behind him, shot him in the back of the head twice with that .40-caliber gun. Versace's longtime partner, Antonio D'Amico, was just inside the gate having coffee on the veranda. Because the house had stained glass windows, he wasn't able to see what had happened, but he could hear it and he knew that it was bad. Mm-hmm. He and the butler jumped up and ran for the gate. That's when they found Versace lying in a pool of blood. He was rushed to Jackson Memorial Hospital's Ryder Trauma Center just 7 miles away, but by 9:15 a.m., he was pronounced dead. Gianni Versace was only 50 years old at the time of his death. News of his murder spread like wildfire. People crowded the mansion to see the blood-stained steps. We actually have a picture of that here, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Ooh. Yeah.
It's awful.
I get it. I get that people are, like, interested and want to know what's going on, but it reminds me of the Black Dahlia episode that we did, too.
Oh, yeah.
Where, like, people just, like, were walking all over the crime scene, mm-hmm. taking pictures. Mm-hmm. It's just weird.
Oh, no, it's super weird, and I didn't include this in the episode, so my research isn't super good on this because this is just something I read in passing that I'm now bringing up and don't have much backing for it. But there were people that like rushed the scene, took pictures, and then tried to sell pictures of Versace's body for tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's disgusting.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, there was also like a bloody dead dove that was found on the mansion steps beside Versace's body. This is an odd story. Many took it initially, you know, before we knew that Cunanan was behind the murder, initially, they thought it meant like perhaps the mafia had been involved because sometimes that was a symbol of the mafia to leave a dead bird behind.
Yeah.
Others had considered this to just have, you know, like a more spiritual meaning that Versace had passed on to a better place of love and peace. But ultimately, it was just a really weird story of wrong time, wrong place in which this dove ended up getting caught in the crossfires during the murder.
That's like when that... Have you ever seen that video of the baseball player that
hits the bird?
That hits the bird and it just f***ing explodes.
Yes. Talk that about wrong time, bad wrong timing. Place. At least it went quick.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't suffer.
No. Because he exploded.
Yeah, I've seen it. And I mean, this is, isn't that crazy?
That is crazy.
Crazy timing that this bird just like flew by right and caught a bullet. So I'm not going to show the pictures of the bird here because they're just really gross. But you can actually find pictures of the bloody dove if you want to Google them.
I'm good.
All right. The location of Versace's mansion is a pretty public and well-known place. So when Cunanan shot him, there were eyewitnesses. Mm-hmm. People watched as a man in a gray t-shirt, black shorts, baseball cap, and backpack shot him and then took off. They also found nearby the stolen truck that contained Cunanan's clothing and cutouts of newspaper articles about the other murders that he had committed. He's just carrying those around with him.
Yeah, killers do that.
Oh, trophies, right?
And something that the show dives more into than obviously this very mm-hmm. like abbreviated version mm-hmm. of it is like his motives behind it. And maybe we'll touch on that once this is all done.
Yeah, we're going to touch on motives a bit.
But like he, at least again on the show, mm-hmm. I haven't done as much alternative research mm-hmm. as you have, but like he wanted to be special. He thought he was special mm-hmm. and he wanted to be known and almost like he wanted to be a celebrity.
Yeah.
And so I could see how like, oh, this is the only recognition he's gotten.
Right.
You know, in his life is this, oh, look at these things that I've done is making the news.
Which is so awful. But yeah, I mean that he took pride out of seeing his handiwork, I guess, is the really morbid way I'm going to reference it in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of these people that was murdered, Jeffrey Trail, David Madsen, Lee Miglin, William Reese, and Gianni Versace, every single one of their lives matter. Every single one of their deaths is tragic. But of course, it was the murder of Gianni Versace that captured international attention and that got the FBI working in overdrive.
God, this reminds me so much of the what's happening right now. Uh-huh. What's her name?
Gabby Petito. Yeah. I mean, we could talk about that too, where like her life matters. And it's good that so many people were paying attention, are still paying attention. I mean, it shows that your everyday person can help, like, solve crimes.
Yeah.
But it also highlights how much a pretty white woman.
Social media.
Someone that's on social media versus the hundreds of indigenous women that have gone missing from the exact same location where she did over the course of the last 10 years that have never once been highlighted.
Yeah.
Following Versace's murder, at the height of the pursuit, there were some 1,000 agents working on the case. That's how much this thing got like pushed into overdrive.
That's I mean, like, his life matters, like you said, but like, that's ridiculous.
But so did everyone. Oh,
but so
other
did everybody else's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
With the world looking for him, Cunanan didn't have many places to hide. For a whole week, the country would search for him. And then on July 23rd, authorities were tipped off that he was hiding in a houseboat along the Miami coast. As they approached the boat, they heard a gun go off. On July 23rd, 1997, Andrew Cunanan, spree killer, took his own life with the same gun that he had used to murder so many others. So why did Cunanan kill Gianni Versace, much less all of these other people? We already kind of talked about some motives.
Yeah.
We won't ever officially know.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
But of course, that hasn't stopped people from speculating. Yeah. I mean, like, hey, that's why we're here.
That's so. Kind of what we do here.
That's kind of our job. So I do think it's clear that Versace was targeted. Cunanan was staying in a hotel only 4 miles from his Miami Beach mansion.
Yeah.
It was also widely known amongst Cunanan's friends that he was obsessed with the fashion designer.
Yeah.
As we discussed early on in the episode, Cunanan was a compulsive liar. And one of the things he lied about the most was that he and Versace were personal friends. And while authorities were never able to find a link between the two men, and the Versace family continues to deny any connection between them to this day, it is possible that Cunanan and Versace actually did meet prior to his death. Journalist Maureen Orth of Vanity Fair was the first to reveal that in her extensive research, she had found that the two men had actually met in San Francisco in 1990 when Versace was in the city designing costumes for the San Francisco Opera.
Mm-hmm.
But Orth contends that there was never anything more than this one chance encounter. So is it really possible that this encounter happened and that Cunanan obsessively stalked Versace for the next several years thereafter? I mean, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
There's also speculation that his killing spree was largely based out of jealousy. Perhaps he was jealous of his two friends, Trail and Madsen, for having successful lives and romantic relationships. And then that jealousy was magnified by Versace, an outwardly gay man that, you know, had a very successful career, lavish lifestyle, and a loving partner.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, there were unfounded rumors that Cunanan was HIV positive and was therefore taking out a vengeance on gay men.
Meh.
I think that's really stupid, but it came up in all my research, so I thought I had to mention it.
Yeah.
This rumor is totally unfounded. Cunanan's autopsy would show that he was not HIV positive.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless, we do know that all Cunanan ever wanted was to achieve fame and notoriety. And he certainly did that through his murderous killing spree of 1997. So perhaps for him, it didn't matter how exactly he achieved it.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of Cunanan's motives, Versace's death left a gaping hole in the fashion industry. At his funeral that occurred in Milan on July 22nd, approximately 2,000 people showed up. So check out this picture here. You can see some well-known people that were in attendance at his funeral.
Yeah. So the two I recognize is Sting.
Yeah.
And Princess Diana.
Mm-hmm. In his will, Versace had left 20% stake to his sister Donatella, 30% to his brother Santo, and 50% to his niece Donatella's daughter, though she was only 11 years old at the time of his death. When she inherited her stake when she turned 18 years old in 2004, she inherited approximately $500 million.
It's good to be a Versace.
Versace. After Versace's death, Donatella would take over creative design for the company and Santo would continue as the CEO. Like I mentioned earlier, as part of his will, Versace left his partner, D'Amico, nearly $60,000 a month and the ability to live in any one of Versace's properties. But since the properties were technically owned by the Versace company, not Gianni Versace individually, Donatella was able to keep D'Amico from moving into one of the residences, and she was also able to limit the amount of money he would receive.
I don't like that at all.
That's shitty.
That's shitty.
And in the show, so I read some interviews with Donatella because people have asked her, like, how has your relationship with your brother's partner changed since your brother's death?
Yeah.
And she has said, like, it didn't change at all because I didn't really talk to him before. And now I obviously don't really talk to him. They just didn't like him. And in the show, in the series,
there was a reason. Didn't they, like, think he was cheating or something like that?
They just implied that he was kind of more of a money hungry type person. He was just there for the fame
but,
and
I mean,
the money.
He was there for like how long
15
did you say?
Years.
15 years.
Yes. I know. That's how I feel about it too. I do think, you know, sometimes your family does know better about your relationships than you do because they can see from like an outsider perspective.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, Versace chose to keep that person in his life for 15 years. He mattered to him.
Yeah.
He was his partner. He was his best friend. And then they totally cut him out in every way that they could following Versace's death.
That's horrible.
Yeah. In 2018, the Versace brand was bought by Michael Kors for $2.1 billion, but Donatella continues to be involved in the business.
Oh.
To end this episode on an odd, eerie note, I had to mention that in 2021, so this year, the day before the 24th anniversary of Versace's assassination, two men were found dead of an apparent double suicide or murder-suicide inside the Miami Beach mansion. Authorities still don't really know exactly what happened, what the order of the deaths were, but how odd and eerie is it that it happened right there? What? At the anniversary.
I have to think that was probably intentional.
Oh yeah, I do too.
And also less likely to want to stay at that hotel now. So.
Yeah, a little less likely.
A little less likely.
Because now it's extra, extra haunted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Hashtag History.
We will share the pictures that we discussed on the episode to our Instagram, and all sources used to put together the episode can be found on our website, which is at hashtaghistory-pod.com.
Subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you use, share about us with your family and friends, and then give us a rate and review.
And circling back to Instagram, be sure to check us out on there at #history_podcast, and you can also find us on TikTok at #history, all one word.
And come join us over on Patreon, where for as little as a dollar a month, you can help support our books and booze supply. This is where you will get access to behind-the-scenes content, weekly hashtag hangout episodes, and we mail you cards and stickers.
And now, to announce next week's special guests joining us to close out our season 8 finale.
We are super excited to have the fabulous Caitlin and Sarah from Luminol Podcast on the show next week.
Woo!
Yay! We will be discussing a disappearance and murder that is not very well known, although it should be, since the legacy of it continues to this day and is very much a part of our nearly everyday lives.
Yeah.
That's
going to be good.
I can't wait.
Yeah. Be sure to tune in next week for our super special finale episode with our wonderful guests. We hope to see you there.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye. Bye. This is Hashtag History episode 78. I'm Rachel.
Nope. 79.
It literally said, okay. Firth.
The first.
He was born on 31st.
That's like how Ed Sheeran, in that one song says 31st Street or something like that. What is he saying?
I don't know.
Oh my God.
I thought I knew all this stuff.
Photograph. That's the song. And it's...
Wait.
On 30... No, not 31st.
Fifth Street.
Wait. He says...
Down on 6th Street.
Yeah, he doesn't say 6th. He says 6th. And listen to it. It's going to drive you insane.
I will listen to it on the way home.
Okay.
Why do I... I have to pause before I say it.
That's fine. There's one more syllable in it that I think you're...
Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Minneapolis. I think I only say it like two more times.
Well, that's good. Yeah, because he's about to do damage and then just leave. So.
Right. We're not there long. Where he began staying at the Normandy.
I
do you say it?
You Normandy. Said it right. Normandy.
Normandy, the way that it's spelled?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not Norbody.
Norbody, bop. Morbidy at the Morbidy Plaza. Oh my God.